Well, this Saturday, I wanted to let you know that I will be in Milwaukee at the Havenwoods State Forest. It's our WPR Listener Appreciation Event. It's an open house. It's from 10 to noon at Havenwoods State Forest. And so I'm really looking forward to this coming Saturday. And I also wanted to mention that next week, Friday, I'll be broadcasting live from Bayfield and Bloom's Garden Expo. This will be the 17th year in a row that I've done this that particular program, so I'm really looking forward to that. But again, this Saturday, if you're in the Milwaukee area or want to drive there, go to the WPR Listener Appreciation Event in Milwaukee. It's an open house from 10 to noon at Havenwoods State Forest. Won't cost anything. We'll probably have some, I don't know, some things to give away, I would expect. At any rate, it's going to be a lot of fun. And it's always a lot of fun to talk with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, with me right now. Steve, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. John Martin, a professor in that same department, will be joining us in a few minutes. He's just finishing up with his class that he teaches, and he'll be with us to talk climate and weather. I thought we were going to talk about all the snow that might be falling in Madison today, but it's been rain.
It's been rain, and this past weekend we did get some snow. Hopefully, yeah, You'll have a nicer weekend in Milwaukee next weekend. But
I'm hoping.
Well, I think you probably will. Saturday or Sunday?
Saturday.
Saturday would be fine. It'll be upper 60s or something like that.
So, oh, that's so good.
So that'll be nice. Right.
It's so good to hear. And by the way, as you listen to Steve and I talk, and maybe have a question about climate or weather, I don't know, we were supposed to get 5 to 9 inches in the southern part of the state, and we didn't get that. Well, maybe we can talk about why that failed to occur, but also take your questions, or maybe if you've got a great weather experience to share, I hope you'll join us for that as well. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. So it just got a little warmer than we expected, I guess.
It got a little warmer, and also what really happened is the system was further south than initially predicted, so we didn't get the 6 to 8 inches that they were forecasting. But, you know, I will say this in defense of the forecasters. I'm not a real great forecaster. John's a much better forecaster. You know, they were calling for this in a week before it actually happened. And, you know, by Thursday and Friday, there was posts, you could see this from the Green Bay office and the Sullivan office, talking about that the system may be further south, in which case we wouldn't get nearly as much snowfall. In Madison, we did get some. I think the official amount is 1.5 inches. But, you know, the thing is, it's hard to measure snow now because as soon as it hits the ground and the snowboards, you know, they're warm, so it kind of melts up.
My daughter was playing in the state music competition at UW-Whitewater, so we drove on Saturday from Madison to Whitewater along the interstate, and there were points where you could not see very far. The snow was coming down pretty hard.
You know, even in Madison, it came down pretty hard at times. And, you know, was it a bus forecast? You know, I planned back on Monday not to do any garden work on Saturday. So, you couldn't.
And I didn't.
I stayed inside. I waited till Sunday afternoon.
Oh, man. Well, you know, it really wasn't that far off.
It really wasn't. You know, it was kind of miserable. Yeah, 6 inches is a lot. Even if we did get 6 inches, there probably wouldn't have been very much on the road anyway, because the roads are still pretty warm, and so it melts pretty quickly.
How common is it to have snow this late in the year in Wisconsin?
You know, it's not late.
Huh?
It's not typical, but not uncommon to even get snowfall in May. The real danger becomes how heavy it is. You know, by now it's going to be heavy. If you picked up the snow that was out, it was very wet. And so if it sticks to branches, you know, we'd really run into the risks of, you know, breaking branches off of trees and things like that, bringing down power lines. That's the real danger.
Yeah, on Garden Talk this past Friday, I think a large percentage of the calls were people asking, what do I do with my flowers that are up, or what about my little small covered bed that I've got, or should I cover the bed? There were all kinds of questions like that on this last Friday's Garden Talk show, for sure.
Yeah. My tulips did fine. The tulips seem to do it in them.
I mean, they're tulips, daffodils. I mean, they're used to.
They're used to this kind of weather, right?
Yeah, absolutely. John in Boaz has a question for you, so let's go there. Hi, John. Thank you for calling.
Hi, I would like to know about the cycles of the sun and how they affect our Earth's weather system concerning the sunspot cycles go in 70-year periods, and I believe we are entering into another cold, such as the Ice Age period.
Yeah, we're not heading quite that bad. The latest, what we call Little Ice Age, didn't have any sunspots on it, and that's certainly not the case. We're coming out of a situation where we had fewer sunspots over the last 11 years. The sunspot cycles run in what's often called a 22-year cycle. But if you look at the number of sunspots, that's an 11-year cycle, and they flip magnetic signature code or every other year. So we often call it a 22-year cycle. So there's no doubt that the solar output has an impact on climate in a big sense. But if you look at the sunspot cycles every 11 years and then try and find patterns that match that in terms of weather patterns, we don't have any real strong correlations between the sunspot numbers and weather cycles. So it's an area we're still investigating or doing research on, but it's a tough thing to pull out.
What the heck is a sunspot?
Oh, good question. So a sunspot is, if you look at the sun, it runs through a cycle where it also is a big convection ball where there's a lot of convection going on because it's a very hot fluid or hot plasma. And the sunspots are areas where they're cooler than normal, than the average spot, the average temperature of the sun. But they're also accompanied by what's called a facula, I think it's how you pronounce it. And those are areas where it's brighter and more intense than the sunspots and the average temperature of the sun for that particular time.
So those are kind of shooting out and having some impact?
It indicates an active sun. So when you don't have sunspots, it's often looked at as a quiet sun. So we don't have a lot of coronal mass injections, that kind of activity.
Oh, all right.
Which really affects the electromagnetic field of Earth and our electronics. And those can be really dangerous if we get hit by one of those.
What about, just back to the snow for a minute, some areas had a sort of a reddish tint to the snow. That was the beginning of April?
Yeah, that was the beginning of April.
What the heck caused that?
That was actually a dust storm in Texas and Arizona. Two days before April 8th, there was a big outflow from a thunderstorm, can pick up dust and suspend it in the atmosphere. And it's very small soil particles. And then the weather systems then carried it up our way, where it interacted with precipitation, with snowfall, and fell down on the snow and added a nice tint of orange or brown to the snowfall. Or even on cars. People I know were emailing me and John and saying, what's this stuff on my car? It's like, it's dust from Texas.
Texas dust.
Dust, right.
Well, there are some things I like from Texas, but I'm not sure the dust is.
It's not that. But dust can get transported a very long distance. So there's Sahara dust that we actually find in ice cores of Greenland. Dust from the Gobi Desert also gets up to Greenland. So that's thousands of miles that can be transported.
And it's way up in the...
It goes, way up in the atmosphere. And, you know, it's heavy, so eventually gravity will pull it down. And then once it gets wrapped up in a weather system, the precipitation, whether it's snowfall or rain, will then wash it out.
Brett emailed that he downloaded climate data from NOAA, and it lists three different pressure readings: local, sea level, and altimeter. What's the difference in which one is listed in the local NOAA report?
Oh, that's a good question. Local is what's often listed, and that's what we would measure at the ground surface. But if you put that on a weather map, all you're going to see on surface pressure, surface local pressure, is geography, because the higher you go, the lower the pressure gets. And so they normalize it to sea level. And that's what you often see on weather maps. And so, then altimeter is for aircraft. They kind of pick a reference height so that everybody's flying at the same altitude. Because we don't want people thinking they're flying at the same altitude and they're not.
So the pressure, so we, do we need to worry about it?
It's important to look at pressure drops and things like that. They can tell you how things are changing and what kind of weather activity is coming. This is how our grandparents did weather forecasting with the barometer.
Yeah.
To watch how the pressure was changing. And that indicated if a front was coming and whether it was a cold front or a warm front.
Steve Ackerman, our guest today, John Martin, soon to join us, our two weather guys talking climate and weather. We are going to take a quick look at the news and weather, find out what else is in store for us on the Ideas Net, and we'll be back with our guests. So you stay with us. Thanks so much for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here taking a look at weather and climate with our weather guys. John Martin just joined us. John, good to see you.
Good to see you, Larry.
Yeah, John's a professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences, as is Steve Ackerman. Hi, Steve.
Hello.
And so, what weather questions do you have in your mind? What climate questions? Are you curious about changing weather patterns or maybe the recent weather events we've had? Join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. And let's take an email. Jerry emailed that at a forum recently about global warming, there was an objection from the audience that the hydrocarbon links to global warming are not proven but only modeled. The audience member asked for scientific proof, even though we were showing the usual graphs about temperature rise that seemed to parallel the industrial age. Any comment for that particular climate change denial argument? The Heartland Institute argues that the rise in Earth temperatures precedes the increase in atmospheric carbon. Therefore, they claim that atmospheric carbon doesn't cause the temperature rise. What are your comments?
It's not true. It's an assertion. It's absolutely
You're
beyond,
talking about now the Heartland Institute.
Yeah, it's beyond reproach that that the carbon dioxide fraction has increased and forced the increase in retention of greenhouse gases. It makes perfect physical sense. The opposite doesn't have any logical basis whatsoever. It really doesn't.
Yeah, and I would argue, you know, that it isn't just models, that actually is observations.
Right.
We understand the physics. You put carbon dioxide into the environment, and it's going to cause a warming because it doesn't absorb solar energy and it does the infrared that the Earth emits. So it is proven without even modeling. You just look at the data and look at the correlations and the causations that go with it, and it's pretty clear. The only time we really use modeling now is predicting in the future what's going to happen in 2050. And even in those cases, when you take out carbon dioxide and look at what's happened over the past 100 years, so going back, with carbon dioxide in the models, it matches pretty well what we observe in terms of surface temperatures. And when you take it out, there's no way that it can actually measure. So it's both the physics we know, the data shows it, and the models are consistent with what we see.
On that note, we turn to a different question, this one from Brent in Little Chute. Hi, Brent. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. The reason I'm calling, I learned last year about this concept of wet bulb temperature that measures both heat and humidity at the same time, and I was terrified to find out that human beings can't survive beyond a certain level of combined heat and humidity because their bodies just can't shed heat without being in air conditioning, and that apparently over in Iran a couple years ago, they came real close to hitting the point where human beings just start dying because of their own body temperature. And I was wondering if there's any models that indicate what will happen in the future here in the Midwest regarding heat and humidity, because last summer it sure was a sweaty job working in the garden, I can tell you that.
for sure. All right, Brent, who wants to take that?
You know, Steve? The issue is with regard to the temperature and the wet bulb temperature, which tells you how hot it is combined with the moisture in the atmosphere. And it's related to another parameter, which we call the heat index, which is a measure of whether or not what it feels like in terms of how your body can cool down. So the way our bodies cool down in hot weather is we perspire, and then that perspiration evaporates, and the evaporation causes a cooling. And so, yeah, if it gets really hot with a very high humidity, it becomes very difficult to evaporate the precipitation that's on your body, and therefore you can't cool down. And the heat index is a measure of that. And if the heat index gets too high, then we're in threat of being ill, particularly people who can't regulate their body temperatures very well, like elderly folks and young folks.
Yeah, and In theory, if the dew point temperature got to your body temperature, you'd have real problems. Yeah. Because when you breathe in air with that kind of a dew point temperature, then that means it's going to condense at 99 degrees Fahrenheit. And that's not the temperature of your lungs. They're going to be a little bit cooler than that. You're going to coat your lungs with water. But the record high dew point on Earth, I think, at the surface is something in the mid-80s. And it is really stubborn to move it forward. So we don't run the risk of having dew points that are so high that you drown while you breathe. I don't think that's in the future for our planet.
Yeah.
So there you go, Brent. I hope that helps. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Mike in Madison has something for us next. Mike, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. along those lines, because of the dangers involved in climate change and extreme weather and heat index, it almost makes me think we ought to be, as public radio stations, even commercial radio stations, issuing public service announcements advising people that the more kinds of activities that they do, like flying, that put more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere and therefore created more of a danger to the human race. I mean, this is a public service announcement.
So kind of like maybe high carbon days?
Yeah, Steve? In some regards we get that. Like when we broke carbon amounts in the atmosphere of 400, there was a lot of news articles about that. And that's sort of a way to raise awareness. We do have high pollution days, and we do warnings around that as well. The thing with carbon is that it's not an immediate danger. It's more of a long-term danger. So you'd almost be putting one out all the time just because of that trend of how we're increasing carbon dioxide.
Yeah, and I think the EPA, under the prior administration, worked very hard to get carbon dioxide as a pollutant on a list, right?
That's right, so they can control it.
Well, I think that's been rescinded, not surprisingly, and maybe they'll have to do something along similar lines again.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for calling. You know, I've read a couple of articles recently that have been critical of, in general, of weather forecasters on TV, for example, where they have not, the writers in both cases had not felt that they had done that weather forecasters have not done a good job as it relates to climate change and educating the public about this particular issue. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about it. I mean, for one thing, again, when you look at weather forecasters, particularly TV weather forecasters, when people turn them on, they want to know what the weather is coming necessarily. Yeah. And so that's their main job, I think. And every now and then they will talk about climate warming, increased number of days where the heat index gets above a certain amount. So I think they do a pretty good job now. Certainly, I would argue maybe 10 years ago that was less of or more of an issue, and that they weren't communicating the proper science in climate change, but I think most of them are doing it now.
Yeah, and Bob Lindmeyer here in town, he organized a conference with one of our colleagues in early November where he did exactly that it was his purpose, get as many broadcasters, as many Weather Service people, as many academics together and just see what's the landscape really like. What are the challenges faced by all those different communities about communicating, you know, these issues? And it was really worthwhile. So there's a there is an interest among broadcasters to do that, and hopefully that'll continue.
Yeah. Let's go to Lloyd in Madison next. Lloyd, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hello? Is this me?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Thanks for calling.
Okay. Could the astronomers explain what is the altimeter height and what's the interrelationship between the altimeter height, acute mountain sickness, and decompression sickness and diving?
Okay. Well, I'm not sure about decompression sickness with diving because I don't like to dive. Mm. But altitude sickness, you know, that is something that is a threat when you or anybody goes from sea level or even from Madison to the, you know, Rocky Mountain areas of Denver or Wyoming, where all of a sudden the oxygen has really dropped down. So I don't think it's so much the pressure as it is not having the oxygen.
It's density,
The density to do that. and that's a problem. You're really supposed to go and get accustomed to it. And, you know, my family, we lived in Colorado for a number of years, and it was great to come down to sea level because you had all this oxygen when you wanted to do some exercise. But now I have family that lives in Wyoming, and when we go to visit, you know, I got to spend a day recuperating.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. Thank you very much for calling. And Mark in Oconomowoc, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I was thinking about the response to these guys who made the comment about Heartland Institute saying it's not proven. And I heard that line years ago when I said something to someone. And she said, well, it's just not proven. And so what I've been thinking over the years was about scientific method. And your guests would do better on that since my memory isn't clear. But I do recall that there was like you move from an idea to a hypothesis, and then you test the hypothesis, and then you get to a theory. And so this woman was saying, well, it's not proven, or it's not a fact. And I was thinking, well, in scientific method, you don't really seem to have much facts other than there is no data. So, I mean, the argument is like, it's like talking, speaking English to somebody, a Chinese physics teacher. I mean, he'll know it, but it's you're talking two different planes. And I don't know. Anyway, yeah. when I looked at it that way, it just made me feel better. It's like, okay, this person just doesn't, you can't talk to this person.
Well, that's often the place where people who are, you know, ardent skeptics and who sometimes have an agenda in their skepticism will turn. It's not unlike the evolutionists or the anti-evolutionists will say evolution's not proven, and they're not wrong. You know, it's true. It's the best available theory to explain the panoply of observations that we have about how species have speciated, mm-hmm. and then genetics wasn't even there when evolution was first proposed by Darwin, and genetics fit right in hand to glove. And so the same thing is kind of going on here when people will say something like climate, carbon dioxide making the planet warm hasn't been proven. They can, first of all, define what their proof, the level of proof is for them any way they want, so they can remain skeptical forever with that line. And as you point out, science is a activity in which we're building explanations, and explanations are always theoretical. And very often those explanations have really quantifiable results. This one that we're talking about does. It's quantifiable. You can actually demonstrate that this is a relationship that's robust. But that doesn't always serve to satisfy the most ardent critic, because they'll just say that it's not proven to my level of proof or something like that.
Yeah.
It's not fair, as you say.
Yeah. Thank you, Mark. Good point. Carl in Verona, it's your turn. Hi, Carl.
Hi. I wish your guests address the really catastrophic warnings you hear from some people, like Guy McPherson of the University of Arizona. They point out that the feedbacks, the nonlinear exponential feedbacks that are now in play, put us on a path to very catastrophic changes in like 10 years or so. They point to the very rapid changes that are occurring in the Arctic much more quickly than was thought would happen. And there's so many positive feedbacks. occurring now that they think that disaster is imminent. Could you, your guests, address that, please?
Sure.
Yeah, it's a good
Steve,
question.
Yeah,
you know, it's how do you predict into the future? Do you extrapolate, or do you do modeling, or do you look at linear trends or whatever? I think you're right when you point out to the Arctic, the way we've been looking at Arctic change and our understanding of it is not matching the rapidity of which we're actually observing. And so you see that, for example, in sea ice cover, the predictions from year to year of what the sea ice cover should be in terms of how it's decreasing. It's decreasing at a much faster rate than the models are predicting, which therefore influences our understanding. And not in a good way, I should say. They're going away faster. And then you see the impacts on the ecosystems. You know, the tundra is warming up. The permafrost is warming up. And this just leads, I think, to the fact that we have a very complex system, and how those things are going to interact and result in change 50 years from now is pretty tough to
figure out.
That's
right. Yeah, it's an extraordinarily complicated, well-balanced situation. And some roads of possible change have been closed off for so long that they're effectively dead ends. And if you just do a little bit of warming, all of a sudden a whole bunch of different things that have been out of play can come into play. So it's really tricky. Even one of the things about the health of the sea ice is currently under debate. Is it always weakened only by the extra warming during the summertime, or is it weakened by warming that goes on in the wintertime because of increased cloud cover at low elevation over the Arctic? This is a currently hot topic. So there may be two things that are working to do damage to the sea ice, not just one, and that's going to change the way we think about that particular aspect of this problem. So they're infinitely complex and very interesting, and we try our best to get on top of it with the observations that we have.
And I think you'll see a wide variety of how people interpret that data and what we're looking at. You know, some going to, as you're pointing out, an extreme changes that we'll never be able to recuperate, to the distribution where people just ignore it and say that we're not warming. And so there is a big range of how people are interpreting the data.
Mm. Carl, thank you very much for. By the way, what's the modeling for Wisconsin in 50 years in terms of its? Are we going to be Missouri or
It's something like Missouri or Arkansas.
Yeah, northern Arkansas.
Yeah,
not the mountains.
The mountains, right? Yeah, no. I still think we'll have some winter and snowfall.
Yeah, me too.
It's kind of hard to believe we wouldn't have those Arctic outbreaks come down.
Yeah, I think some of the elements that force the changes are slowed by some of the feedbacks that we're talking about.
Yeah,
and we don't know that yet.
Carl, thanks again. Ralph in Eau Claire, it's your turn. Hi, Ralph.
Hello. I have a question about the term ceiling in they talk about weather. What is it? And
yeah,
more information.
I'm going to make a joke about pumping your head, but I won't do that. It's used to measure where the lowest cloud base is. And that's pretty important around airports for landing and takeoff to know where the clouds are.
So the ceiling refers to the lowest clouds.
It's the lowest
cloud. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's from the bottom of the cloud to the ground.
To the ground level. Yeah. Right. Yeah.
Bottom of the cloud to the ground. Okay. Yeah.
And I think there's probably restrictions on people who aren't instrument related in terms of flying.
That's right.
What kind of ceiling they can fly under. The height of that base of the cloud.
Yeah. Well, that makes sense. There you go, Ralph. Thank you. Andrew in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Andrew.
Hi, guys. How you doing?
Good. Appreciate the call.
Great. Yeah. So my question is in relation to the nitrogen cycle in the atmosphere. And a lot of attention is put on carbon for good reason. But I'm curious about what affects the Haber-Bosch method of taking nitrogen out of the atmosphere and turning it into ammonia for industrial agriculture uses. And then the effects of those basically soils that are ammoniifying all the nitrogen that would be labile in soil. What effects all that's having on the climate and atmosphere in terms of the nitrogen going on and how that's affecting us?
Okay.
Yeah, I think it would be a very indirect term in terms of how nitrogen interacts with radiation, and that's what really causes the warming. But as you're pointing out, it could change an ecosystem and how the ecosystem exchanges energy or chemistry with the atmosphere above. Hmm. But I think it would be a secondary effect.
And nitrogen's the most plentiful molecule in our mixture of gases, too. So yeah. we're not running out of nitrogen. But no matter what we do, we can't exhaust it.
Oh, yeah. There we go.
But it does cause air pollution problems as well.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Ozones and things like that. So there's that aspect of it, I suppose, in terms of climate change. If we're getting warmer, we may be producing more smog events, which would involve...
Yeah, those are hydrocarbon-induced, though, right? And temperature-induced. So you got to have the hydrocarbon effluent first.
Yeah.
So it won't just happen by itself.
Yeah, good point.
There you go, Andrew. Thank you. Sue in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I was wondering, I saw an article about planting a trillion trees and getting rid of global warming, which I don't totally accept, but I do think that planting a lot of trees might be helpful. Do you know if there are any efforts in that, and would that be helpful, especially out west where it's supposed to be getting drier and drier?
You know, there are definite efforts where people are planting trees to offset their carbon budget, for example, because trees do take out carbon from the atmosphere. I mean, that's what they use to build up their plant material. So it's a okay way to do it, I think, in the short term. But when those plants die, those trees die, then they're putting the carbon back in the atmosphere.
Yeah.
So I'm not sure it's a long-term solution as opposed to a smaller term.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah.
But still a good idea.
I like trees, so yeah.
I think it is an unmitigated good
idea. Right, yeah.
So there you go, Sue. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Charlie in Milwaukee, have you got a quick question for us?
Hi, I was just hoping your guest could comment. I'm often amazed at the people who criticize smoking and the association with lung cancer will often attack the statistics, even though it's pretty much common sense that cigarette smoking will cause lung cancer. For climate change, I've also heard some of that, too, that there's an attacking on the statistics and how the research is done to justify global warming. Would your guest please comment on the scientific rigor? Did the standard deviation and the standard errors that are using these statistics, do they really point towards warming, or is this still kind of common sense that hasn't met up with that people are using statistics to make everyone confused?
Yeah, just to be quick, I would say that, yeah, definitely the statistics is aligned with the global warming that one sees. I think the point is, I know, you know, people who are denying that climate change at one point was taking a temperature in 1998, which was a very warm year, and then drawing it down to 2010 and saying,
right,
look, it's
right,
less, therefore it's cooling. And that's not an appropriate use of the statistics.
And on that note, we are out of time. You guys are back the last Monday of May.
Well, the last Tuesday, maybe? Don't you do your bird show on Monday?
That's Memorial Day.
I think it might be the last Tuesday. You're absolutely right.
Mm-hmm. See, we do this often enough.
John, Steve, thank you so much. John Martin, Steve Ackerman, our weather guys from the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have them along, and they'll be back. And you know what? I hope you'll stay with us, because there is lots more in store here on the iNeas Network right through the afternoon. So stick around.